Successful software starts at Raygun.com. Raygun APM provides .NET application performance monitoring unlike anything you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers more than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one powerful solution. You can monitor unlimited hosts, enjoy richer trace data and call stack information, and unblock those hard-to-solve performance bottlenecks that affect your web and mobile apps. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality and try Raygun free at Raygun.com. That's Raygun.com today. This is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hanselman Minutes. And today I'm talking with Eva Ferreira from Buenos Aires, Argentina. She is a professor at the university. She is the organizer of CSS Conf Argentina, a Google Dev expert, and a front-end developer. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I am very well, and I'm happy to be chatting with you from so far away. Thanks for coming on the show. I'm checking out the website for CSSConfAR.com. This was the event that you organized in August of last year. How did it go?
It went great. We have almost 400 attendees. It was an amazing event with a lot of people coming from abroad, even from different countries in Latin America. So it was really nice.
Yeah. And when you put on an event like this, you're doing it as a nonprofit, but I think sometimes what does the customer think, or what does the user think? Does the community think that you're going to get rich and famous because you made a conference?
Well, probably yes. There are not many people who think that way. But since, at least in Argentina, we don't have many of these events, it's really difficult to explain to the people what goes behind doors when we make it. And sometimes, yeah, people might think that we want to make money out of it, and especially since we actually charge a ticket because that's what we need to actually run it. So there is kind of a misconception sometimes about making nonprofit conferences and how you kind of prove that it is actually nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. So you have to prove that it's nonprofit. And I've noticed that some conferences do a better job than others about letting the community know when a conference is by the community and for the community. You actually published a by-the-numbers post where you explained everything from how many tickets you sold, how many tickets you gave away, and even some context about Argentina's economy.
Yes, we felt like there was a need for us to publish that because it's the second time we make CSS Conf. We didn't do that in the first edition because we were like overwhelmed for like how much work we had. But when we start planning the second edition, that just at the very beginning, we actually said to ourselves, hey, we should release the numbers because after all, we have nothing to hide. And it will also explain the value of the ticket for the people who are from Buenos Aires and also from the people who are from United States or Europe, where you have a very different price. So it's really good to be able to explain through all those numbers what is going on in some economy, in some country, and how you can make a great event with the priorities right, diversity, community, without like expending a lot. And it's great that we can actually show it to the people, and people really appreciate it. It had a wonderful feedback.
Mm-hmm. And this was 9 months worth of planning. So you started planning in December of 2017, and the conference took place in August. And there's a couple things that are worth pointing out there. You make the comment that the monthly salary of a web developer in Argentina might be $1,000.
Yes. And usually the employees don't really pay the ticket the employers don't really pay the ticket from the employees. So it's out of the money of the people to attend. We don't really sell tickets to companies. We sell tickets to people. So it's out of their own pockets. And the economy situation in the country is pretty bad. Last year, there was 50% inflation. So planning ahead and actually saving money for an event is really complicated for the people in an everyday basis.
Mm-hmm. And you also pointed out something really interesting, which I did not even consider, was that the US dollar at the beginning of your planning was one US dollar, was about 19 Argentinian pesos. And then just 9 months later, it was basically double that, which must make it very hard to budget for an event.
Yes. And in fact, we are used to dollar going up, but we even planned for dollar going up a little bit in December, but we didn't have that in mind. So it was a really huge amount of inflation last year. And it was so hard because we actually made a mistake of saving the money from the ticket sales in pesos. And you don't do that in Argentina. You don't save money in pesos because then you will lose a lot. So we have an issue with the conference that we lose a lot of money in the middle because of that.
Oh, you mean you put them like in the bank in the wrong currency so that when the currency fluctuated, you had less money the next day?
Exactly. Yes. That was a big issue. Yes. And after all the expenses, the flights, the hotel reservations, they are all actually in dollars.
That's a good point. Now, all the while, you're also trying to get sponsors. So you had Mozilla and Google and DataArt all helping you sponsor flights, hotel nights. And you had a clever idea that maybe they would not give you the money directly.
Yes. And that was really great because we didn't want to go through the hassle of like taxes and all that. And after all, what we wanted with money from sponsors was to be able to make the event. So we proposed to the sponsors, hey, can you cover this flight? And they were glad to do that. They were really excited that we were able to provide the transparency in that way as well, not them giving us money, but actually them paying for the expenses itself. So it was really good, and we had really good feedback from sponsors as well.
That's a really smart thing to do, and I was really impressed about the level of transparency. I feel like every conference should do this. People, I'll put this a link in the show notes, but people can go and see exactly what you paid for the venue, how much you paid for, you know, communication and talking to the people who came, paying for speakers to come. And, you know, paying for everything. Like, you even put in, like, their hotel, how much breakfast, who was business class. You even bought them Argentinian chocolates, and you kept track of all of these costs. And it was really cool that you put that on the thing. And then you said that we have about $331 left.
Yes.
Which is not exact, but close.
No, but close. It took a lot of time, but I think, I really hope more conferences will actually work towards that, well, that openness, and trying to spend a little bit of time on making those things open to the community. So it's easier to understand the effort that goes behind that.
So it sounds like it was a great conference, but it's a huge amount of work and it's still a nonprofit. So will you do it again this year?
No. We need to take some time. We need to sleep. But next year, in 2020, we plan to be back.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I think that when we, the public or the community attends a conference, we appreciate all of your work, but I don't think we really understand the amount of effort that's put into something. You could spend all year organizing a conference. It's exhausting.
Yes. And it's also really stressful. I mean, suddenly you have a product of $20,000 on your shoulders. And it's so much work, and there's so many people involved, and it has to go right. It doesn't have to go wrong.
Yeah, that's extremely stressful. So not only do you organize the conference like this, but you also are a professor at the National Technological University in Argentina?
Yes, yes. I have been doing that for a couple of years.
Yeah, and what are you teaching?
We are teaching front-end developer and a little bit of back-end right now, so it's really nice.
Mm-hmm. How much challenge do you have when you're teaching web development to students that may have different levels of English proficiency?
It's a lot of challenge because on one hand, you have to suppose that, okay, this is people who are already in university, so you have like this kind of supposition in your head that they will have a good level of English because they reach university. But the truth is that it doesn't happen everywhere. Our language is Spanish. And at the same time, if you go to public television, you turn on the television, or you even go to non-public channels, and you put a movie that will be in Spanish, you actually end up like even watching Friends TV show in Spanish. So if someone gets to university, that doesn't really mean they have a good level of English. And the hard thing is that you have such a different variety of levels of English in a course of 20, 30 people, that it's really, really hard to know how much resources in English you can actually give them without being unfair to a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? Because someone's skill level, or someone's, let's just say their talent, their ability, their inherent ability to be good at web development, it doesn't necessarily need to be attached to their English ability. There's lots of developers that are amazing developers, but they don't have fluent English.
Yes. It should never be a barrier, but it is, mainly because the majority of intermediate to advanced content of web development and teaching educational stuff is in English. It's not in Spanish, it's not in Portuguese, it's in English. So that is a big issue. What I usually try to do, but it's not the solution, sadly, is to try to give them something from perhaps MDM, Mozilla Developer Network, because they have a lot of good articles with good translation. And even though sometimes they are the Spanish version is a little out of date, but at least you can show them, okay, if you don't get everything that is going on, you also have this website that will be able to help you.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the right thing for people who are listening, like we have our people who are listening to this podcast, my Spanish is not very good, therefore this podcast is in English. What do you tell the listener? Should they all go and make advanced technical content in their local native language to help people? Or should we have everyone learn English and improve their English? What's the solution?
I think that language shouldn't be a barrier. And I think that it shouldn't be a barrier for getting a raise at your job. So I believe that on one side, we really, really need content in our own languages because of trying to bring down that barrier. But at the same time, we also need content in our own languages simply because it's a cultural thing as well. I mean, I really enjoy reading books in Spanish. I enjoy it just because, you know, that's my language and I get along with it really well. My jokes are way better in Spanish than what they are in English. So I guess it's also about spreading our culture and being proud of the languages we speak.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that, you know, there's the joke about, I mean, perhaps you've heard this, right? If you are trilingual, then you might be a European, or if you're bilingual, you speak two languages. If you're monolingual, you're American. And I think we just assume that everyone should learn English, and then we think that maybe a computer translation is an okay solution. No. But I think if it's not a good solution, is it?
No, and I have a really sad story about computer translation. So I was teaching Git one day at university. And I have one student who had Good Translate, the extension in the browser, installed. So he went into github.com and he clicked on the translate button, so all the website and that in Spanish. And funnily enough, not only the website got translated, but also the code samples. So suddenly, that poor student thought that Git add was actually Git agregar. And he ended up writing Git agregar, the Spanish version, in the console. And that didn't work. And he didn't understand why. So yeah, automatic translation, no, it doesn't really work.
Oh, that's awful. Yeah. I mean, if you're mixing code and you're mixing prose, those things are going to get translated. You're going to lose keywords. You're going to lose context. And even if we think we're being helpful by doing automatic translations, often we're just going to confuse the issue for people.
Yeah, you have to be really careful and try to test it and be really sure that it actually works.
Hey, folks, you're a very good developer. Probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. Now, you've given talks in multiple languages all over South America, all over the world. You've switched kind of smoothly between languages. Do you try to give advanced talks to make sure that there's more advanced content, or are you focused more on beginner talks to get more people involved in web development?
No, it always depends on the target, on the audience, on where I am speaking. If I'm speaking at a conference or a meetup, I usually give advanced content because the audience will understand that. But if I'm teaching, I just begin with a basic level because that's what my students will understand. So it's a mix, really.
Mm-hmm. Do you, your English is fantastic.
Thank you.
So compliments on that. I'm curious though, what do you think about the fact that there's probably a lot of people out there who have great information, but because they don't have fluent English, that they are afraid to present? How do we get people to present in their native language, do videos, do workshops? Because I want to get that information outside into the world, you know, put that good information out so other people can learn from them.
That's something so important. And I heard it a lot. Like, people are kind of ashamed of the way they speak, or maybe of their accent, and they don't want to. They are afraid people will make fun of them. And honestly, no way. I mean, you speak more than one language. You should be proud of yourself. It doesn't matter if you have a little bit of accent. And it's a real thing. People have actually talked to me about that. And they told me, no, I don't really feel like giving a talk in an international conference because my English is not good enough.
So you also have a focus on accessibility. And I know we've talked a little bit about language and how language is a thing that keeps the web from being accessible to people. But what are some other things that you're excited about on front-end development to make the web more accessible?
Well, accessibility is something that I began working on like 2 years ago, very kind of recently. I think they go side by side because it's a way of opening up the knowledge of the web, of the internet to more people. And this shouldn't be, it's another barrier that we should just put down and help people actually get the information without any issues.
Mm-hmm. You gave a talk, and I'll put a link in the show notes, called The C is for Accessibility. What is the C? What do you mean by that, the C is for accessibility?
Oh, that's a really bad joke we make in people who like CSS. We usually begin sentences saying the C is for cascade style sheets, but we totally change that, and the C is for cats. So the C is for accessibility. It's a really, really bad joke about a talk of how CSS impacts accessibility.
It does, because people have so much power in their CSS. It's one of the main tools that they have available, but a lot of people don't realize how CSS can impact contrast and visibility and pseudo elements.
Indeed, people usually think that CSS is the last thing on accessibility, that everything is about HTML and JavaScript, and it is about that, but also a display none will make a disaster if you don't do it right in accessibility.
Mm-hmm. And you talk in your talk on accessibility about hiding, about visually hidden and semantically hidden. Maybe you can explain the difference between those things.
Yes. Well, when you visually hide something, you are actually hiding it only from what we can consider the sighted user, but you are actually providing that content to the screen reader user. For example, the skip navigation links. skip navigation links are something that you put at the top of your website. So the user that uses keyword navigation doesn't have to go through all the menu if they want to get to the content. So they just click on the skip navigation and jump into the main content. That's great for non-sighted users, but also for people who prefer keyword navigation. So you can visually hide it from common users and activate it and make it visible through keyword navigation on Focus. So that would be a use case of visually hidden. Semantically hidden would be something like perhaps hiding the content from the user who is not sighted and showing it for the user who can actually see. That, let's see, a use case for that would be maybe, this is going to be a really silly use case, but if you have an image, that image is not really important. So you just hide it from the non-sighted user so they don't waste their time, and you show it to the other kind of user.
And that makes sense, actually. Like, I have had times where I put an image in, but it might not be an image that it really deserves an alt tag. It doesn't add any semantic value. So I might want to, like, I don't want to hide information, but at the same time, I don't want to waste their time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting. And a lot of those things are, again, coming down to empathy. You have to remember that people view or see the web differently. As a sighted user, I don't think I've ever seen skip to main content, but a non-sighted user sees that all the time, every day.
Yeah, and it's something so important because when you start like practicing with screen readers and with keyboard navigation, you suddenly begin to realize how annoying it can be to browse the web without a skip to navigation links, because you just have to go through each one of the links in the navigation with your tab keyword. And you can spend like half an hour pressing tab until you finally get to the content.
Mm-hmm. You also point out that the visual presentation or the order, the way that we see the order of something, sometimes because of the way we've coded the website, isn't necessarily the DOM order. And that can be confusing to a screen reader.
Yes, because you can actually change the order of elements with this order property in CSS. And that will alter only the visual part, but it won't alter the DOM order. So if you tab for it, perhaps if you are a sighted user who cannot use your hands really well and you use a keyboard, then the navigation will go perhaps the other way around. And it's not necessarily wrong, but it is confusing.
And I think that if you had a form that had that problem, I know that a non-sighted user would use their keyboard and they could find themselves bouncing around the form and not understanding what's going on because the order is not the same.
Yes.
So is this something that, this seems overwhelming as a person who is a kind of a full stack developer, it seems like you would really need a dedicated team or a dedicated person to keep track of all these different things. I know I'm going to get it wrong if I don't have a dedicated team for accessibility.
Yeah, I mean, in big companies, I think it's almost like compulsory if you can to, I mean, if you can afford it, to actually have a dedicated team. And if you are in a small company, hopefully you will hire a front-end developer who does not only do like React, but also accessibility.
Do you find that this is something that you focus on like exclusively, or are you just have a giant list of stuff that you have to get done on the front end and you do the best you can and just continuous improvement?
I do try to do the best that I can in everything that I'm thrown at, but I do focus on accessibility, and I also try to educate my teamwork in the company I work on accessibility. So in the end, I try not to be the only person who can solve accessibility issues.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I like about your talks and the things that I think make your talks special, and we'll have links, of course, to the videos of your talks in both English and Spanish, is that not only do you do live coding, which I love to do, I do a live coding in my talks, but I think that you also put things in context, in historical context. How important is it for new developers and the developers that you teach at the university that they understand the history of why something is a certain way?
Oh, well, I really enjoy to know why things are the way they are. So I think it comes like natural that I actually try to explain the history of why this is happen- is this thing happening. I do the same when I teach. I don't think there's really a reason more than I like to do that. I like to know why this is happening, so I like to explain it. I just hope people will enjoy the history of things as much as I do.
There's such an overwhelming amount of things to know. If you think about like someone starting today, if someone this morning, anywhere in the world, maybe in Latin America, maybe somewhere, says, I'm going to be a web developer. There's so much to know. There's the history. There's maybe they need to know a certain amount of English. Where do you send people? How do you even start on day one of class one?
Well, it's indeed like an overwhelming experience. Let's see, when we go to class one in the course that I teach at university, it's actually a completely theoretical and not practical class because I just begin talking about the history of internet, how, for example, speed connections actually improve websites. And I think that's the way of beginning is trying to understand how we got here in kind of mess we are right now with so many technologies. And at the same time, it's just try to really teach good basics and then give good resources to the students so they can keep on researching after the courses they want to, and they can actually make themselves experts in a certain area.
Mm-hmm. In your blog posts and in your demos, you use a lot of CodePen. You like have nice, clean HTML and nice, clean CSS. And when I learned and when I was teaching at university many years ago, Vue Source was a big part of my life. And sometimes I see something amazing and I do a Vue Source and I'm sad that it's a mess.
Yes, I'm with you. I think that, you know, performance is good, but we are taking it too far. I really began like you. I began like inspect elements and Vue Source and try to understand how something is made. And it's really sad when you cannot do this anymore because everything is kind of compressed in the sake of maybe 1 kilobyte of 1 kilobyte less of code. So I don't really like that.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. Even when I'm doing an inspect element, I feel like I'm digging through a bunch of divs to get things out of the way because I really want to see how they built this. The web somehow became a thing that we decompile or uncompile as opposed to learn from.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, that's overwhelming. Another thing to point out, last year you put out an SVG animation with JavaScript class at Pluralsight. How have you found learning and how people learn as because you do videos, you speak at a conference, you do a Pluralsight, and then you also do university classes. Which of those has you found the most effective way for someone to learn web development?
I am a strong believer of people having different ways of learning, like I can learn. I learn a lot with someone teaching me, like in person. Maybe I don't learn anything if I want to read a book on programming. I don't really get anything. I'm really bad at reading books. So I believe that the best way for me is having someone to teach me in front of me. But it differs a lot depending on the person. And I guess that's the most important thing, because if you can provide content and learning tools in those different ways, then you can get more people to learn more easily. Like, okay, if you learn better by reading, then this is a book. If you learn better by pressing a class with a person in front of you, you can do that as well.
Yeah, you've got a great blog post on your kind of tips and tricks, clues on how to teach and learn web design. And the first thing that you say is, don't say something is obvious, because it's really only obvious to you.
Yes. That's something really harming sometimes in learning, because we are really used to like writing code and it works and that's it. But for someone who is actually a beginner, it can be so overwhelming, so many tools, so many codes and perhaps not even the code in the language. So you have to be really careful with your language and trying to use the best words in each situation to avoid making someone feel like they are stupid when they are not. They are just learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you pick that correct word, I assume that you're teaching in Spanish at the university in Argentina, but you're bouncing back and forth between English and Spanish. How much time do you spend defining English words or giving how do you know which word is the correct word to use as you are really being bilingual because you're teaching them another language, CSS or HTML?
I don't think there's the right answer to that.
That's probably no good answer, isn't there? That's a tough question.
I just try to do my best. And I find myself many, many times saying the word in the wrong language, like a lot, an embarrassingly amount of times.
Well, I'm certainly not one to speak because I did this whole interview with you in English, so lo siento. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to put links to all the show notes so you can go and see Ava's website, see the videos and the slides of the different talks that she's given, and you can certainly follow her on Twitter. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.